Of course, the second crisis was the Russian invasion of Ukraine. No matter how much you care for it, it's still a surprise. For every key person in the company, you had at least two backup people, who in case something happens, there is no connection, there are people outside Ukraine who can support them. It's basically a missile detection system, and our annotators have to label the sounds of missiles, helicopters, and the algorithm was trained to detect the sound of a flying missile. And this is used to understand where exactly this missile at this moment is heading. You have to be brave and courageous to enjoy the journey that you are embarking on, because being the CEO is about celebrating achievements as well as feeling the pain from some failures and taking on responsibility for maybe some of things that are not as pleasant as you want them to be.
A quick word from our sponsor for this video, Rora. Rora helps top AI researchers and professionals negotiate their pay as they transition from academia into industry. Moving into tech is a huge transition for many PhDs and postdocs. The pay is much more significant and the terms of employment are quite often different. Rora has helped over 1,000 STEM professionals negotiate more than $10 million in additional earnings from companies like DeepMind, OpenAI, Google Brain, and advocate for better roles, more alignment with their managers, and more flexible work. Rora recently released their 2023 AI Researcher Compensation Guide, which I'll link into the show notes. Click the sponsor links to get discounts and support this podcast. All right. So hello and welcome everyone to whosoever's listening to this particular podcast. I have with me today Karina Naminas. She's the CEO of Label Your Data, that provides data annotation services to different organizations interested in developing AI-based solutions. It's good to have you, Karina, today on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Jay. Thanks a lot for having me, and I'm extremely excited about the conversation.
Yeah. So can you tell us a bit about your background for people who might not know? You have a background in journalism, and how did you go from your background in journalism to being a CEO of a company that provides annotation services for AI algorithms?
Sure. I have a background in journalism only as my bachelor that I did for the university. But my professional journey actually started with a gap year that I took between the school and the university, which was 8 years ago. And during that gap year, as I was preparing to do my bachelor in journalism, I actually took my first job, which was a customer support representative in a company called Support Your App, which is now a parent company of Label Your Data. And I always thought of journalism as a very nice cross-sphere education that helped me to learn a lot about different things, learn how to talk to people, how to get to the core of the information, and how to present it to other people in a very understandable way. So I love that aspect of journalism. But again, during that gap year, I started my work. And as I was working in Support Your App, I also started my university. But in my professional journey in Support Your App, I also got promoted a year and a half about after I started to onboarding manager. I worked there for 2 years, and then I felt like I reached my limit. I felt like I overgrown that position. So I came to my mentor, Daria Lyshenko, who's the CEO of Support Your App. And I told her that I want to change something. I want to challenge myself. I want to try something different. And she said, hey, you know, we actually have an idea of building a second company, building a spin-off, which will be focused on data labeling. And that was the very first time I heard about it in my life. But I thought that, okay, that's a nice challenge. And why not give it a try? So we started working on it. We gathered a group of people who were potentially interested in building this new company. And we started to explore the market, just talk to people who could be our potential customers. And it was February 2020 when we went on our first conference where we pitched Label Your Data, which was a very funny story because it was like we just finished the website on the plane on our way to the conference, but we were so ready to let the world know that, hey, we're starting a new company. And that was a conference dedicated to automotive called Auto AI. And this is where we had a chance to talk in person to our potential customers, learn what exactly they are looking for when they're looking for data labeling solutions, what is important to them, take a look at our competitors as well. And we saw there was a big need in the market for such services and that we were ready to accept this challenge. And as we returned back home to Ukraine, COVID started, but also Label Your Data started. We started to receive our first clients in April 2020. And yeah. Just 3 years ago, we celebrated, 3 years ago we started, but just this April, we celebrated our third anniversary.
Yeah, I think one of the key things that stands out is, like, I think you guys started at the maybe the worst time that you guys can see, right? Because starting off a particular company takes most amount of efforts and networking. And I think COVID was maybe one of the few times that gave the hardest amount of time. But before I go into the details of like how your teams progressed after 2020, I also wanted to learn is, so since you said like you have a little bit of different background entering into an AI market, I wanted to learn. So just a third person's perspective onto, like, there are lots of developments in general in AI in the last 10 years. I think after 2012, when the first thing came out and people started investing more in AI. How do you see AI? Like, what kind of developments fascinate you? Because I think in the last 10 years, there have been lots of potential ideas that are being pitched and a lot of solutions that are being developed on top of those ideas. And also recently, I think there are lots of boom around ChatGPT and other things that are just taking away the news highlights. So how do you see AI developments? What do you think is the most fascinating thing that when you decided that, hey, I want to create a company that creates annotations for AI tools?
Sure. Well, right now, the highlight of our work is, of course, generative AI. It's booming and it's extremely fascinating for me to see how, especially, it's going to be living together with artists, with the creators of things. And so I'm extremely excited about that. But the nature of our work in data labeling is particularly great in a way that we have a connection, we can relate to absolutely different applications of AI. So throughout these 3 years of our work at Label Your Data, we've seen so many fascinating projects, so many exciting ideas. Of course, we've been working a lot with kind of a regular AI requests, like facial recognition or autonomous vehicles and stuff. But oftentimes, and it especially is very true for the universities, PhD students and professors who reach out to us, they come up with some extraordinary ideas. Recently, we closed a project where we were annotating a drone imagery of the ships because a student in Australia wanted to develop something like a robot shepherd. So that was a very fun use case for us. I think in the next couple of years, for sure, we will understand that AI is no longer a competitive advantage, but rather a necessity for a business. I'm extremely excited and looking forward to see what the next year, 2-3 years are going to bring us, not even a decade, but I think it's running at super high speed.
And I'll be curious to know, like, are there any organizations that would be using AI not just for AI solutions? So would these kind of data annotation services be used not just for AI solutions? I'm just curious in general. Like, do people reach out to you where the end goal is not to develop an AI algorithm, but still use these annotations in a different way?
Yes, absolutely. So while 70%, well, 70 to 80%, let's say, of our services is data annotation directly for AI, we also offer to our clients different data processing. It can be things like data entry model validation or just some extraordinary data processing requests, like some writing captions to some videos and so on and so forth. So absolutely. I mean, we don't often know the end result of what we're doing, although we always ask our clients about that because it adds a lot of motivation for our annotation team when they know what they're doing it for. But yeah, it's not only for AI for sure. It's everything that has to deal with data.
I see. And you did mention about starting in April 2020. So can you tell me, so I think few of the few things that we discussed in our previous call was within your 3 years of starting this label your data, you faced one of the few biggest crises that I think a company can face. And you being the CEO would be the person who would be handling these challenges. So I think one of few of the key things that come to my mind is I think you, what you said is COVID, because it created a lockdown and hence your networking and in general, getting people to work for these kind of things would be a biggest problem. And also I think the war and the economic crisis that followed after the war created a big impact. So can you tell me how each of these particular challenges affected you and how did you make sure, or maybe what were the key things that you realized that this is how it is hitting or this is how it is affecting our company and what were the measures that you took as a CEO to tackle them?
Yes, of course. I mean, we're looking forward to 2024. We'll see what kind of other crisis is going to bring us, but we're ready for anything. Yeah, I think I'd love to talk about every period separately because it's been unique and every crisis taught us very valuable lessons. It wasn't an easy time, of course, but at the same time, I'm ready to share this experience. So I think with COVID, the biggest lesson that we've learned is that we chose the right industry. While some of our clients in travel or aviation or any kind of offline business, they were cutting their budget and we didn't see a lot of clients from those industries coming in. At the same time, clients from industries of online shopping, retail, e-commerce, or game dev, they started to thrive. And that was the point when we realized that it's so great that we are diverse in our services, that we are not focused on only one, let's say, automotive industry. Let's take that as an example. But we can serve pretty much any industry. And right now, AI can be applied anywhere. So I think regardless of what happens, there will still be a use case for us and, you know, where we can serve our clients. So that was an important lesson for us to learn that we have to remain diverse in our business, in our services. But one interesting case I can tell you about is how we closed a project of 100 on-site data annotators in December 2020, right after the second major lockdown here in Ukraine. So we had this big client that came to us and said, hey, by the end of 2020, it was November, we need to have 100 data annotators in office. Can you do that for us? And we thought, wow, that's a lot of work and that's a huge challenge, especially given that, you know, it all starts to shift towards remote work, lockdowns, no public transport is working. But we thought, you know, let's give it a try. So we accumulated all of our resources, and I think it was December 31st, 6 p.m. when we had our last call with our recruiting team. Everyone was already, you know, wearing makeup and sitting in the next room to their family, but finishing this project. And we actually did. I mean, this project was a shorter, but it was for just 1 year. But during 2021, all of the team 100 annotators, they were sitting in the office, so we made sure they are equipped with everything necessary to make this work safe. And the this kind of requirement came from the client because they were working with highly sensitive data that they couldn't allow remote workers, right? So we had to make sure there was a mask regime. Sometimes we paid for the cab for guys to get to the office, and we had to be ready that at any time there can be an inspection coming into the office and checking if everything is in order. So that was a very interesting experience for us.
Yeah,
of course, the second kind of step for the second crisis was the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which, you know, no matter how much you prepare for it, it's still a surprise. But whenever these conversations started to go on about potential these events unveiling, we started to build a business continuity plan where for every key person in the company, we had at least two backup people who, in case, you know, the contact is lost or something happens, there is no connection, there are people outside Ukraine who can support them. Of course, we built a lot of documentation, a lot of standard operating procedures where we outline every step that someone has to take to make sure that this particular process in the company runs smoothly, even if the responsible person is gone or cannot execute certain actions. So for us, it wasn't, it still is a challenge, but preparation is a key. You have to make sure you have this backup plan, business continuity plan, and you have to stay positive, because regardless of everything outside, we still have to continue living, continue providing the services to our clients, continue providing workplaces to Ukrainian people. So yeah, and in terms of the economic challenges that follow up, right, and we're having this 2023 being not the best economic year for everyone. Again, I think the preparation is the key. I mean, apart from obvious things that you have to be financially prepared for it, right? To me, it was extremely important to be open with the team, because it was the beginning of this year and talks about layoffs in a lot of companies. Of course, the team started to panic a little, but what I had to do, I had to be very open with them. You know, I have to be prepared, but I don't know what's going to happen. But we are kind of all in this together, and I'll keep you posted as soon as I know things, as soon as we maybe change something. And it's also about being adaptive. It's also about holding these strategic sessions with your key team, thinking about, okay, what can we do in a different way? What kind of other services we can offer if something goes wrong in this particular sphere? It's about also remembering that any crisis is temporary, and you just have to make it through it.
Yeah. So I think the key things that what I hear from you is, I think one of the major things would be to make sure that you have a backup plan. So as in, like, if things go sideways or if something doesn't work for any kind of reasons, it could be any external factors or internal factors, you have something that that can be used as an alternative approach in regards to the plan A that you have. And yeah, being open with the team would be really critical, because when you are trying to ship these kind of solutions really fast, it's really critical to have that vision being reflected down the line, and just not you who's trying to make sure that the things are delivered on time. So yeah, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we don't try to overpromise something to our key people, right, in the company. At the same time, we don't, panic in front of them, right? We're just trying to make sure they are confident in us as a company. And at the same time, in this way, we can be confident in them, right, that they can stick with us throughout this crisis. And, yeah, just as you said, it's about being adaptive. It's about not having one person responsible for one process, about having at least two people who can replace each other if something goes wrong.
Yeah. And you did mention about, like, one of the key things was you finding 100 annotators. So maybe I'm just taking a different tangent over here. Is it always so, like, how do you deal with getting the right set of annotators? Let's say if you have a requirement for labeling medical data sets. So would you go about finding people who have medical expertise, or would you be investing more in training people to learn more about what the medical data sets mean and what we are being asked to annotate? How does it go, the logistics of getting the annotation done?
It really depends on the project. And we always stay transparent with our clients. We ask them whether they want people to have a particular medical background, or whether they think them and us on our end can hold enough workshops to train the team. So it was just a case recently where we had to gather a team of 50 annotators to label different legal documentation. And we thought that in the beginning, we discussed with the client that perhaps it would be better to find people who have some legal background. But in the process, as we started doing it, we figure out that people without legal background, they are somehow, they are not as biased as people with legal background are. So they take a more of a you know, critical and objective approach to labeling the documents, what this client particularly liked. So we switched to hiring just people who can understand the instructions and act according to them. In terms of hiring the right people, I think around data annotation, people often think that it's a very easy thing to do. And it is, right? It's a pretty simple task, but it's not for everyone. We know that not every person can remain being productive and remain being very focused and, you know, provide high quality results during even an 8-hour shift doing this kind of job. It takes a lot of responsibility, a lot of attention, a lot of concentration. So of course we invest a lot in hiring the right people. So we don't do crowdsourcing. We rather hire our internal independent contractors. So with everyone, we hold a couple of interviews. We do tests. We pay a lot of attention to the training. So every person does at least a week of training on different types of annotations in order for this person to then be able to switch between the projects if necessary. And in terms of hiring people with medical background or legal background or any type of specific background, we have a pretty strong HR brand, both here in Ukraine and outside. And again, it's about being diverse, because even before COVID, we started exploring different markets. We started to go, we realized that with time, we might receive some clients who will need data annotation services for text in different languages. So our top languages were French and Spanish and Portuguese and German. So we started to investigate HR markets in Eastern Europe in search for German language. We went to North Africa to look for French speakers and Latin America to look for Spanish and Portuguese speakers. We went to those countries specifically to remain fairly competitive in terms of the costs, but also to be able to find the right people who can speak those languages on a very high level, and then who can, you know, annotate data in the specific language. So it's about, for us, it's about being open, doing a lot of research in terms of the market where you want to go, in terms of what people you need to hire to be able to successfully deliver the services to the clients.
Yeah, that makes sense. And would you say, like, what would you say would be the most challenging part of getting these kind of solutions being done? Is it getting annotators or like finding the right set of people that can deliver up to the expertise? Or would you say the right scoping part? Because I would assume, because these kind of problems are not straightforward, because most of the people who would reach out to you would have like kind of a real world problem at hand, where the annotation is really hard, right? Like the annotation is not that much differentiated like cats and dogs images, but they would be much more severe. So would you say the scoping part of the problem in the initial few days when these companies or organizations reach out to you would be the most challenging part, to really understand what they really want, what kind of things are being requested over here?
I think in general, two most challenging parts in data annotation are quality of the data that's being produced and speed of delivery. Speaking about the first one, quality, it's something that our clients ask us a lot about. How can I rest assured that what I receive in the end is what I want from the very beginning? And we do a lot of calls with our clients, and we do a lot of communication to really understand if what we can offer really matches what the client is looking for. It starts with doing a very small free of charge pilot to understand if we understand the assignment correctly. Then we have a separate integration department who is specialized in making sure the instructions are correct and identifying different edge cases, discussing them with the client, including them into the instructions, so that when it's not just one person annotating, but 20 people annotating, that we don't get overwhelmed with a lot of questions, because we describe them in a very profound way in the instructions, that people can always find the answers to those edge cases. It's also about communicating a certain gray zone with the clients, because some clients, they don't want to be too bothered, you know, with a lot of questions from our end when we don't know how to annotate this or this specific thing. And in this case, we agree on a specific, let's say 10% gray zone, where the client trusts us and say, okay, I need volume over quality, for example, right? If we're talking about large amounts of data. And in this case, we really agree on this kind of gray zone where we take responsibility for defining what has to be annotated or not. And it's also about, if we're talking about quality being a main challenge in data annotation, it's also about quality assurance approaches. Because we at Label Your Data have practiced a lot of different QA approaches, and we couldn't stop at just one ideal QA approach to the annotations. For us, it really depends on the project. So for some projects that we work with, we just have an assigned QA team that verifies manually all the annotations, and only then they are submitted to the client. With some other clients, we build a golden data set that then is labeled perfectly and then embedded into what is being annotated currently by the team randomly. So for example, an annotator can do 100 data annotation tasks in a day, and 5 of them or 10 of them are from that golden data set. And then we can just quickly automatically check if the accuracy remains on the same level without having to review all of those 100 data points that were annotated by the annotator. Another approach for very subjective data, especially when it comes to NLP and things like sentiment or intent analysis, right? Where one person can say, yes, this is positive, another person will say this is neutral or something like this. In these cases, we practice like a cross-reference QA approach where we have 2+ data annotators doing exactly the same data annotation task. And then we see where they agree or where they disagree. And if they disagree, we then can either take it to our internal QA team or take these cases to the client. Of course, it is a little bit more less cost effective, but it proves to be an extremely high quality annotations in the end. And speaking about speed, my main rule is don't overpromise the deliverables to the client, because it would be much better if you don't if you underpromise and deliver quicker than you overpromise and start shifting the deadline. I think that's the pain of a lot of clients who outsource their solutions, not only in data annotation. So we tend to not overpromise and be very transparent with our clients. I think the key here when we take on a new project is really about that very initial communication during the integration phase.
Yeah.
Because the projects can be very different. The approaches can be different. And we usually try to give our best practices to the client, say that, okay, from our expertise, we recommend you this and that. But it's always about being that transparent with the client and giving them a very transparent expectations from us too.
Yeah. And one of the key things that you did mention that I was going to ask you as the next question was something you mentioned about the bias within the annotators, right? Like 2+ data annotators. And I think personally, I have never worked with any kind of data annotation tools or people who are providing this as a service. But few of the key things that I've seen, like previous to this one, people were heavily using Mechanical Turk. And when they use these kind of services, biggest problem that comes in, like, how do we handle the bias between different people, right? Because there are lots of volunteers who would be using Mechanical Turk as a partial income or part-time income that you can just do and get some amount of money. But the problem is, like, when you don't have a particular definition for that particular problem, so let's say any kind of subjective bias that comes in when you are trying to give this particular task, it creates a lot of confusion. How do I make sure that these kind of annotations, how do I trust them? And how do I make sure the model might not pick up that as a data bias or ultimately relating to algorithmic bias? So yeah, I think now it makes sense. I think the biggest task would be to scope out the right problem and have definitions, because at the end, there would be a lot of back and forth when you have subjective data points in the whole cohort of data.
Absolutely. And I think it's also about really understanding what you're looking for and finding the right solution, because in data labeling market, you can find a lot of different solutions. You can find a lot of crowdsourcing providers, right, where you can really get a huge variety of people from different countries, of different cultures, of different backgrounds. And that's a benefit if this is what you need, right?
Yeah.
At the same time, if it's just a very clear computer vision task, then maybe you don't need that. You might want to look for a different solution. If you are concerned a lot about security, especially if you process a lot of personal information, we have such clients, especially from fintech industry. We process banking information, documents. We do some KYC procedures for some of the crypto clients. And this is where our clients have to, you know, rest assured that the data is stored and processed safely. And this is when you might want to look not for a crowdsourcing solution, but rather for dedicated long-term FTE teams.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that brings me to another question that I think in our previous call we did get to discuss was, you, instead of just working on few of the open or very easily recognizable problems in AI solutions, you have also been working on very niche projects that relates to military applications. So can you brief more about like what kind of applications you got in the last 3 years that had like a kind of requirement for these kind of annotation tools to make sure that you preserve the purity of labels, because in these kind of scenarios, you cannot really afford that much amount of wrong bias to be included in the annotation services. So can you tell more about like what kind of military projects you worked in the brief amount of time?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we started to work with MilTech industry as the events unfold in February 2022. Kind of the whole Ukrainian IT community suddenly, you know, started to think what we can do, not only on the physical battlefield, but here, you know, in the back end, what we can do to basically defend the country, what we can do to contribute to the army. And since then, we've been participating in three MilTech projects where data annotation was required. All of them, of course, were volunteering for our partners. And the first one was, we were working on, and we're still working, on a situational awareness system. And what we did there, we are labeling, again, the drone imagery from the actual battlefield sites. And our annotators had to label different classes, like a person, enemy, or some kind of vehicle, whether this vehicle is hidden under the trees or it's clearly visible, and so on and so forth. And it was specifically challenging project because it was the first one, and it was in spring 2022, and some of our annotators couldn't even see their homes on these drone images because they were right in the suburbs of Kyiv here, and a lot of our annotators, they come from these regions, so they could actually see their homes, their apartments being occupied by the Russian troops. But the second project that we worked on is called Zvuk, and it's now public. It's basically a missile detection system. So there are a couple of sounds systems around Ukraine, and our annotators had to label the sounds of missiles, helicopters, animals, cars, wind, thunder, and so on that were recorded on this station. And the algorithm was trained to detect the sound of a flying missile. And this is used to understand where exactly this missile at this moment is heading, because the territory is big. And oftentimes, you know, you don't really know where it's heading, and you cannot really identify the exact direction of the missile. So we worked on that project with our annotators. And the very recent one was when I was contacted by a commander on the battlefield in eastern Ukraine about making the artillery more accurate. So it was also about annotating the drone imagery of the actual fighting events happening. So our annotators had to label the actual, to train the action recognition algorithm to be able to really identify the moment of the hit and also where the target and the actual place when it, you know, it hit, the artillery hit. And then it was used to quickly compare whether, you know, it hit the target or no, or there has to be some, you know, correction being done in the coordinates. And it's, all of them have been extremely emotional, but at the same time, extremely rewarding, because you know what you're doing it for, you know, the direct application. And so we heard feedback from our clients that sometimes it helped to reduce the decision-making time from 6 hours to just 15 minutes, which has been, I mean, great. And I'm sure it had a huge impact on the actual events.
Yeah, to me, what fascinates to me the most is like, as people who are working on AI solutions, it's always, most of the people always use it in very sophisticated approaches, like where it's not really on the line of something critical. So most of the AI solutions, if you see, they are typically not used, like they are used for Facebook, Netflix, those kind of applications, which do not have like a very real world impact. And even for medical applications, they are not being used where things are really at stake. So what fascinates to me the most is like at least people like military, people who are dealing with some kind of real world solutions where things can matter and decisions can differ in either directions are maybe approaching AI solutions in some ways or the other. So that really fascinates me, learning like people who are working on these AI solutions that yes, AI based approaches can at least provide you some insights or some kind of decision-making steps that can create a huge difference. And one question that I had for these ones is like, I'm curious, would these kind of applications change in any ways how you are using these or maybe developing these annotation services? So you have mentioned whole pipeline of how you have like a pilot study, you do a Q&A, internal Q&A, and then scale up to like a golden data set and all those kind of pipeline that you have. I'm curious if this varies when you're working with these kind of sensitive data sets. Does that like, do you adapt your pipeline in any ways?
Yes, absolutely. I think when we are talking about this kind of project where there's a lot of personal or sensitive information involved, it is really crucial to make sure the data is processed in a very safe and secure, both physical and network environment, right? That it's not distributed to, and you don't know who is looking at this data, who's annotating it. So when working with these types of data set, the first thing is that oftentimes we have to be flexible, and we are working in our client's annotation environment, because this helps the client to maintain control over the data, maintain control over who has the access to the data. And in this case, we have to be flexible, right? We have to adapt. We have to integrate all of our processes, including QA, training, the actual workflow, counting the statistics and doing analytics, adapted to whatever the client has to offer. And this is not only the case with our military project, right? It's the case with our fintech projects and pretty much any long-term project as well, because doing the annotation inside the tool that was developed by the client or is hosted, right, by the client, helps the client to integrate the model into the annotation workflow, or vice versa, having humans in the loop team assisting the existing model. Oftentimes with our long-term clients, we see how our annotators started to annotate just raw data. If we're talking, for example, about invoices, they started 2 years ago putting bounding boxes and doing the transcription and putting the labels on the annotations inside the client systems. Now, 2 years passed, the client scaled, and now our annotation team works as an assistance to the existing model that the client was developing. And now what they receive at first is an already pre-annotated data that they just need to validate or maybe fix some things that, you know, model did incorrectly. So yeah, being adaptive and flexible when working with sensitive data and being able to adapt to and integrate into the client's and patient environment is a key in this sphere. I mean, when we are talking about working with sensitive data or long-term projects. And another point is, of course, security. I mean, for us, we obtained a couple of certifications, including ISO, PCI DSS level 1, which only banks have, for our clients to rest assured that, you know, everything is being done in order. They should not worry about any potential data leaks or data breaches. And for 13 years since the business inception, both support your app and label your data, we had absolutely zero data leaks incidents.
I think those would be one of the biggest challenges you might be handling as like the head of this particular company, because you have lots of people who are maybe, I'm not sure, most of them would be like a temp worker. So I think it's really critical to maintain these kind of sanity so that these leaks of data are not being breached into this huge institution, because there would be indefinitely in these case of highly sensitive applications, it can change the whole course of the application. And I'm also curious to learn more about, like, do you frequently use any kind of tools, or is it like totally human dependent? Because I would assume even when you have any of these annotation workers working on these data sets can easily amount in the amounts of like 10,000s of samples, or maybe even more than that. So it takes a huge amount of time. So let's say if you have like a segmentation task, it takes a lot amount of time from people to do like a pixel wise annotation. So do you use any kind of tools that are frequently being adopted in these annotation services?
So our focus in at Label Your Data is on manual data annotation teams. But of course, when we see that there is a potential space for us to facilitate and to make the annotation process more efficient by using some existing model or offering some pre-annotations, automatic pre-annotation to our clients, of course, we are open to discussing that. And we offer this if we know this is going to speed the process up or make it more efficient. And again, as I mentioned earlier, a part of the tools that facilitate and make the annotation process more efficient is already developed by our long-term clients, because they've been working on a model, now they want to make it perfect. But we are also now investigating a lot of open source models, like Segment Anything model, right, or ChatGPT, to see how it can make our services stand out, maybe, right, from a competition. And to be honest with you, at one point it scared me, because I thought that, okay, well, maybe in a few years' time span, you know, there won't be a need for data annotation at all. But we did research on that, and we were also talking to a couple of partners from the same industry. And it appears that a lot of our clients, they come, again, with very niche requests. So it's not as easy right now as labeling vehicle or pedestrian or cat or dog, right? It's more about, for example, in-depth 3D cameras that are able to detect very distant obstacles on the road, or labeling regulatory legal documents where you have to apply one label out of 50, depending on the document type, and you have to actually look through it and, you know, determine, and there are a lot of subjective things to it. So we are open to using those tools. We use them with our clients, but we don't rely completely on them. Because even in the recent couple of months, we've been receiving incoming inquiries from the clients who specifically highlight not AI-generated annotations. We need very precise, manual, human annotations. I guess they might want to reduce certain bias from existing models in this way. But yeah. And we see that the labeling market is expected to grow from $5 million in 2022 to $22 billion in 2037. So that gives us hope that, you know, there is still a lot of things to do in this field.
Yeah, makes sense. And just to maybe dig more is, you did mention about, like, let's say you would be curious about using these kind of models like Segment Anything or ChatGPT. So would that be something of a potential utility for you guys? Is like, can you use these models to initiate an annotation? So let's say you have like 10,000 samples to be annotated using Segment Anything. You apply the model and then that will serve like as an initiation point for these annotators. If the annotation is wrong, he or she will definitely just make a tweak to that annotation and save that as annotations. Would you consider that as a potential utility of, or when you work on these solutions, it is completely off the charts and you rely typically mostly on like annotations from scratch from humans?
No, we're absolutely open to using them. And right now, our technology department, together with our marketing, we're seeing, we're looking for alternative solutions to just manual data annotation. What we can offer, because again, if you're using an existing model, of course, it cuts time for the annotation. Hence cuts the cost, for example. Yeah. Right. So we're open absolutely to using them, but at the same time we have to be open with our clients, because when it comes to ChatGPT, of course, everybody's a little bit worried about things like data security, right? So we cannot use this tool without letting our clients know that we will be using it. So in the end, again, the core of everything, of course, is this human impact, humans in the loop teams. But if any model will help us to make it even more efficient, then we are absolutely, you know, open-hearted to that, and we'll be using it.
Yeah. And one of the good things that I can say about annotation is, because I deal with a lot of doctors over here, and most of these applications are not very straightforward. So for example, when I'm working with people who have background in Alzheimer's disease, migraine detection, the key problems, like it's very easy to use a model like Segment Anything and segment out the stuff. But the key problem that still remains is, what are you exactly segmenting? So it's very easy to have a solution that segments, let's say, 10,000 things out of one image. But the problem really remains from a medical standpoint or any kind of other applications is the domain knowledge that is required. So let's say if I segment one part of the brain, like the key thing is not to segment, but to label them. And that really requires an expertise. And most of these doctors or people who don't have a tech background, they don't really trust the models till now. So I would still think like it would take maybe 5 or 10 more years to maybe initiate a trust so they can totally trust segmentations directly coming out of AI model. So before that, I think they would still rely on people who have human expertise or in any way some kind of instruction that can lead to lesser bias. So there are, like, I would say, yeah, on top of the chart, I think a lot of people have the understanding that yes, AI models can segment anything, but it's still very far from reality where they use in real world scenarios.
Absolutely. And if we're talking about Segment Anything model, of course, it's trained on a huge amount of data, right? But again, if we were to apply Segment Anything model to our current niche requests, it won't perform as good because oftentimes we are receiving some blurry images or we have to segment the objects that are very distant on the image. And this model just doesn't capture them, doesn't recognize these things. And if we're talking about medical data, because it's not that, you know, there is not a big variety, for example, in color scheme or anything, it can also capture some of the irrelevant pixels, right, on the medical scans, for example. And in this case, what we also considered doing and what we did with some of our projects is that we built like Python plugins that highlighted the scans that had, you know, the areas on the scans that are less than a particular number of pixels, so that our annotation team can then just go through that specific set of the images picked up by this Python plugin and validate them. So this validation is still absolutely necessary, especially in these niche requests or where you know that the data is not of, you know, super high resolution or high quality.
Yeah, true. And to be honest, yeah, most of these AI applications are really narrowed AI applications, right? So like, let's you have one model that works on I mean, I'm just sticking with brain data because that's all I can talk more is like, I think let's say you have a model that works with brain data, that really works with brain data itself. But at some point or not, it will always use some kind of ground truth that is being trained on. It's fine. Mm-hmm. Like in future, it will work on unsupervised data sets or something like test data set where it can improve and further improve. But at some point or not, it will use some kind of ground truth that is being provided by human experts. So that is the beautiful thing. Like we don't yet have like a general AI model that can work on anything, right? So like you cannot have one model that can also segment animals from image, that can also segment brain regions from brain, and also like you said, like labeling, let's say, flying missiles. So it's like you need to have different models for different applications. And yeah, the opportunity for having good annotations still remains, at least in the next few years for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I wanted to switch gears and maybe learn more about your role as a CEO at Label Your Data. And one of the key things that I'm personally would be curious is like, you're fairly young in your age to be a CEO at Label Your Data. And I also wanted to learn, a lot of people would be curious, like what does the role of a CEO really entail? So we did talk about like, how did you manage and adapt in the times of crisis? But on a general good day, I hope those are the days right now for you. I don't know if those are the ones. But on an average day, what does the responsibility of a CEO of a company look like? What are the key things that you deal with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for the question. I think the role of the CEO is different depending on the age of the company and depending on, you know, whether it's an enterprise company or just a small startup, right? At this point, Label Your Data, I have many hats to wear. It starts from strategic decisions. It starts with discussing with our board which direction the company should take in the next 3-5 years, what goals we set in front of ourselves for the next year, both financially and in terms of the product development. It's brainstorming our value proposition to our clients. It also has a lot to deal with operation, right? It's about having that strategic session in the beginning of the year and then really making sure it's being executed correctly and it's being broken down to different departments and that the goals throughout the year, they are being reached. It's also a lot about talking to people in the company, right? It's about building the team and making sure the people who are heading different departments, you can trust them, you build relationship with them. It's also a lot about just hiring right people to the company and being involved even in those, in that interview process. So right now it's an extremely interesting journey for me. It's also right now it becomes more and more about being a public face to the company because we are attending different conferences. We're trying to, you know, build also PR in Label Your Data, both as a brand of a data annotation company as well as the HR brand, right? Because right now we really want to, we've been focusing on attracting more clients for the first 3 years, right? To feel, you know, safe standing on our feet in this sphere. But right now we really want to build the HR branding as well. The people in Ukraine who work for Label Data outside Ukraine, whatever markets we're going to go, they know who we are. They know what kind of employer we are. So we're moving in that direction too.
And I'm also curious to learn is like, what kind of metrics do you set for yourself? Because let's say for engineers or people who have like very defined roles, it's very easy to set metric. Let's say I have a particular task to be delivered in 1 month or something, that is like the small sprints or anything, whatever terminologies people use in different teams. There is like a very strict metric that a person can follow. And like as humans, we are very good to follow a very small end goal rather than having like bigger long-term goals. But as a CEO, I would assume like you have much long-term goals. that have a lot of moving parts, a lot of dependencies. So what are the kind of metrics you use for yourself to evaluate your performance on a daily basis or maybe like on a short-term basis to make sure you're not heading down the wrong path? Because let's say if you realize you are you were on the wrong path 6 months later, it's too late to revert back and make damage control. So what kind of metrics do you make sure? And I'm sure like there are more than one metric, so feel free to share them. Because like you said, like there are lots of things, hiring, strategic decisions and lots of time. But what kind of things have worked best for you?
So in my case, my kind of goals, they are equal to the company goals, right? So I'm the one who reports to the board, right? Who reports to the co-founders, investors. And basically, if we say that we want to reach, for example, this financial goal or product goal by the end of 2023, it's me who is going to be responsible for really, you know, making sure that it happens, whether I would have to talk to the head of the department who is going to be actually doing, you know, and delivering this, or, you know, it's some sort of a financial goal where pretty much everybody is involved in reaching it, including marketing, sales, and service delivery, and cost optimization, and so on. So really, to me, my goals are the ones that have been set up on our yearly strategic sessions. And then we usually, I personally have this monthly strategic task audit for myself, where I have all of these tasks broken down, and on a monthly basis, I go and review them. I pick up the ones that I can focus on this month that are relevant, you know, for this particular period. And I focus on them. Sometimes there are a lot of, as you said, operational things that just squeeze into the day and you get distracted. But I learned to cope with them. Actually, it was a hint from Daria, mentor, CEO of Support Your App. She once said to me, you will never be able to accomplish those big strategic goals unless you just clean one day, set this focus, turn off Slack, or, you know, disappear from inbox for one day and really focus on that. Let yourself think, maybe sit there for an hour. Just think about how you can approach this task. Maybe this would be the right way to do it. Maybe another way would be the right way to do it. So I'm now practicing this approach. If I have a strategic task that I have to complete, I'm just clearing one day in a week and I'm focusing purely on that task. And yeah, I mean, the metrics to me are mostly the financials and product development goals, as well as my well-being, to be honest, because I know that if I'm overwhelmed, if I don't feel like, you know, I'm in the right place, this will be automatically translated to the team. So as Daria said to me once, that I came to her and asked, okay, I know we have leads, clients, team, finances. Help me to build the right priority. What should I focus on first? Because I think it's going to be financial metrics that I should be focusing on first, and then the team, then existing clients, and then leads, potential clients. And she said, none of that is correct. You know, the first place is you. You have to feel that you're doing the right thing. You have to make sure you're in that kind of, you know, in the right position, that you are happy with what you're doing, you're being rewarded by the results you receive. And only then, okay, then it's finances, clients, team, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think because one of the key daunting things I think a CEO's role is, because even I have worked with teams where like there is a certain set of people where there are people from different backgrounds. Like for example, when I worked at Amazon, I was working with people who have like fitness backgrounds, because we were developing a product that requires, like that was kind of an AI-based solution for workouts. So I was working with a lot of people who had like background in workouts and like just like how the human body works. So let's say if you're doing a workout, what it does to your body, and like whole biomechanical analysis of body. the key thing or the key challenge over there was to deal with people who do not understand tech or how AI solutions work, but we still wanna make sure to have them on the same board because we are trying to deliver an AI solution. And one of the key things I can imagine, because if I scale this particular problem to 10 times or 50 times, is like you have people working with different backgrounds, like you said, finances, even audits, people from operations, I don't know how a whole set of departments itself. So the key thing is to understand how to motivate all these kind of people to a particular one set of goal. So I wanted to learn, like, being a young person in the team, how do you particularly develop a leadership personality in the team? Because like you said, because you are setting the long goal. So when you're setting this long goal, you have to make sure that these goals are reflected in each of these teams and hence each of the employees of your company. So how do you make sure, or what kind of insights you have working with the company in the last 3 years to set a leadership? And first of all, if you want to start off, like, what do we exactly mean by leadership? What do we mean when we say that good leaders lead company to good places? What do we mean by leadership itself?
I think it all starts with a mission. Mission that I believe in myself and that I translate to the team. It's, for us at Label Your Data, the mission is, the global mission for us is the co-building AI-driven economy, right? It's not that we develop something ourselves. We help other people to build this economy. We take on some mundane tasks, right, to free their time. They can focus on the actual development. They can, you know, focus on actual breakthroughs. And another mission for us is here locally, right, in Ukraine too, to provide the workplace, safe and stable workplace to people. So to me, it's about the mission that I personally believe in and that I communicate all the time to my team. It's about doing what I love, what I enjoy, going back to journalism, right? It's knowing a little bit about everything. And with our clients, when they come from absolutely different industries, it's, you have to give that small talk, whether you're talking to a person who comes from agricultural background and they want to develop some harvesting algorithm, or someone who is working on a robotics or a medical sphere, right? So it's about the diversity of the background. It's also, I think, leadership is also about knowing what it's like to be in other shoes. Because given my background, I've been working as an annotator myself. I remember the first days of Label Your Data. I've been doing QA for some of the very first projects myself. And I felt the pain completely of people who were, you know, checking some of the badly annotated images and you have to correct them, and you understand that you spend a lot of time on it. And at that time I was thinking, okay, what can I change to make this process less painful to people who will be doing it after me? What can I do to make the hiring process different? Because when we had to close this, you know, 100 annotators project, I was also involved in just calling people because we were short of hands. And I was involved in those processes. So it's really about knowing what it's like, and for other people to know that you've been in their place and you know their pains, you can share them, listen to them. And it's also about constant learning. It's about being open to the ideas that come from your team, and being open to implement them, to discuss their pains, their challenges, to be able to celebrate their successes and to know what e-success really means to your team. I think it's about those very, you know, deep things that don't really rely on, that you cannot really, I think, learn in any kind of management course, or it's really about experience.
Yeah, I love what you said. I think the key thing that you said was you yourself worked as an annotator. So now you can relate what kind of challenges, like, let's say if something's taking too long than what was really planned out for you, exactly know, or maybe you can relate up to a certain extent what went wrong. And hence it helps you strategize those things a little bit better rather than just having very strict deadlines. Okay, let's have this annotation done by like just 3 weeks. You exactly know how much in reality it would take. like, because if you have like 100 workers or 50 workers or 30 workers, it helps you charter out these deadlines or milestones much better. And that in fact reflects better from the people itself, because they know they have been given a rational amount of deadlines rather than just a superficial one.
Absolutely. And especially if we're talking about cross-departmental communication, everybody who joins Label Your Data, not for the position of data annotator, it can be a backend Python developer, it can be a content writer or account manager or pretty much whoever, they have to pass this 1 week of working as a data annotator, so they know what lies in the core of our services, so they know what people who are working for us, what they do and what kind of services we provide, how many different types of different services and data we work with. So that helps a lot in making sure that every new person who joins the company, they are on the same page with everybody else.
Yeah, I love that. And one last question I have for you before I sign you off is, a lot of people would be interested, because I think when I work with a lot of researchers, oftentimes they have like lots of great ideas and they want to pan out into a, like, let's say a particular product or like a small startup or even like a big company. But one of the key things that really daunts them is like to lead this particular thing into a product or solution, because it's very easy to create a project and propose an idea, but versus it takes a huge amount of effort that we discuss in this particular podcast itself, is to take this to a working condition where you have people who develop to this product that scales, that delivers, and the whole feedback of client and company goes into. So what kind of advice is, if you were to look back, that you would suggest to anyone to make sure that he or she has before diving deep? Or would you just say that getting your hands dirty and just getting started into these roles is the best way to get started? Or if there are multiple ways that people can do, what kind of advices you would give to either of these options?
I think there are tons of advices I can give, but something that I was thinking about, I think that if you want to become a CEO, number one is you have to be brave and courageous to enjoy the journey that you are embarking on. Because being the CEO is about celebrating achievements as well as feeling the pain from some failures and, you know, finding your way around things and taking on responsibility for maybe some of things that are not as pleasant as you want them to be for happening. I think it's a lot also about things that you mentioned, right? Getting your hands dirty and being ready to really work hard and start from something maybe simpler, and building your way through it. It's also a lot about taking on the opportunities that cross your way, because I'm not in any way special or different to any other person. I was just grabbing on the opportunities that crossed my way at one period or another. And I was ready to accept those challenges. And I always thought to myself that, okay, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out, right? It's not the end of the world, but I would regret it if I didn't try it. And I think one of the key things here as well is, you have to make sure that your personal values match the company's values. Of course, it's easy when you are building the company from scratch, but if you are, you know, joining a company, being a CEO, you have to make sure that your personal values in your personal life, whether it's honesty, integrity, responsibility, whatever it is, they match those of the company that you are heading. And I think the last thing is that it's no easy job, to be honest, but it is definitely a rewarding one. I love seeing how the team makes their successes, how they grow, and how we build this together. I mean, it's hard, but it's definitely something that I don't regret, and I love it.
Yeah, I think it would relate to one of the ideas where people say like big risk, big rewards. So I think you are taking those big risks to make sure things get delivered, and that also aligns with your particular interests. And ultimately, it reaps for like bigger rewards. And one thing I also wanted to maybe ask more is you said about failures. So I can really imagine like people can take failures and interpret those failures in many different ways. But being a CEO of a company, how do you handle failures? Because at the end, you might also have to communicate back with the whole team and make sure that like what we can get insights from. So how have you learned taking failures when you are working on these kind of projects? For whatsoever reason it fails, it's not just you. You have to report. You also have to report to n number of people. So how do you, what kind of things have you learned from dealing with failures in these scenarios?
For me personally, I take time to process it myself first. I know I can be emotional when it comes to failures. And I have to take that time, whether it's hours or days, to process it myself first without communicating it, unless it's urgent, of course, but without, you know, going in public and, you know, telling them something went wrong. If we're talking about the team, my team wouldn't let me lie that I'm not the one who goes and shouts and everyone that, you know, we did something wrong. You'd rather sit calm with a cold head and say, okay, what do we do to make it not happen again? What do we do to make it fix? And what in the processes led us to this failure? What should be fixed in our process to prevent it from happening again? And when it comes to reporting to the board, or for example to our co-founders or to investors, again, I'm trying to be transparent, but I think Daria taught me that whenever you have a failure, you have to come and not just tell about the failure, but you already have to come with a couple of solutions on how you're going to fix it. And right now it became so automatic that even in my head, I started, you know, questioning myself, okay, this that happened, what do we do now? What do you suggest? What are the solutions? And, you know, it leads me to certain solutions and answers, and I don't have to go somewhere to look for those solutions. So yeah, it's really taking time to process it yourself and to calm down, and then with a cold head, go and fix things.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. I hope I can relate to this someday, but definitely it makes a lot of sense thinking from a distance. Yeah, definitely. It's not an easy job, but like you said, like big risks, big rewards. So it really pays off at the end. So that if your personal goals align with that particular mentality, that yes, I'm okay with taking big risks, and ultimately I'll be happy with big rewards. So yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, with that, I think those were the whole set of questions I had for this particular podcast. So thanks a lot for sharing them. I think we got to learn more about your background and also what Label Your Data does. And I think the whole idea of how annotations really work when you're asking for services from professional companies like yourself, how annotations really work and how they are being used in the real world. And also the idea that yes, there are lots of AI solutions that can do that, but yeah, definitely it comes with a cost of ambiguity. So it's something that people need to know, because yeah, a lot of claims have been made right now that yes, AI can do that, but that's not the scenario. It's like maybe just a very small fraction where it can work, and even in with that, it comes with a big cost of ambiguity. So yeah, we got to discuss those ones and also some niche projects that you guys are working on with military and other stuff, and also your journey to being a CEO and what kind of key insights you have for young people who might be aspiring that for. So thanks a lot for sharing. Hopefully it is insightful for people who are listening to this. And I'll leave a link to your company and also your profile on LinkedIn so that people who are interested to maybe learn more about your background and just remain updated to your happenings, they can do that. But once again, thanks for being here. And it was fun to learn more about you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Shay, for having me. It was a very pleasant conversation. Of course, if anybody has any questions, feel free to reach out. I'll be happy to help and happy to talk. Thank you very much for the time.
Awesome.